The purpose of my paper is to provide some historical perspective on the question of how we to determine quality of life, which of course we can do by asking the question, what is quality of life? It is helpful to refer to the various indices that Robert Harris just mentioned, one of which is the rather, I think, well-known Human Development Index devised by the United Nations about 20 years ago, a hybrid measure of human well-being or human development that is comprised of three major variables: economic output captured by average per capita GDP, life expectancy, which is of course a proxy of health and other important factors, and education, literacy, school attendance, school completion rates, and so on. Now, it's a useful index because if we compare human development rankings with more simplistic measures, such as simply GDP, important differences emerge. This is the top 10 ranking from the latest Human Development Index from, I believe, 2009. There are no great surprises. It's usually Scandinavian countries and a few others. But if you compare this to rankings according to GDP, be it nominal GDP, simply number, an amount of dollars per capita per year, or income in real terms adjusted for purchasing power, you see that some, in fact, half of the countries that rank very highly in terms of this composite measure, Human Development Index, are also found in the top GDP ranks, but others are not. There are, for instance, mineral-rich countries that do very well in terms of GDP, but not so much in terms of the other indicators, such as literacy or life expectancy. In fact, if you look more closely, you find quite striking contrasts or divergences, at least in some cases. For instance, if you look at the upper half of this group, you see that currently or formerly socialist countries tend to do much better in terms of overall human development than we would expect in terms of the economic output, which now tends to be very, very low. That's simply a function of regime type that used to deliver public goods in the areas of literacy or health. At the opposite end of the spectrum, you find countries that do very well in terms of income. It's especially mineral-rich, oil-producing countries, but they don't do nearly as well in terms of other aspects of human development. Now, if you look more closely still, you find that the United Nations have tried to take account of a huge range of other factors and variables, all of which are quite obviously relevant to an understanding of quality of life. And I'm not going to read out the whole list here. You see it ranges all over the place. It has to do with inequality, political rights, human rights, safety, crime rates, the state of the environment, political participation, all kinds of things that enter the equation that help determine people's overall well-being and levels of development. Now, to make matters even more complicated, there are rival indices out there. The Gross National Happiness Index, pioneered by the Kingdom of Bhutan, that tries to counter more Western-centric ways of looking at the human condition, privileging aspects such as psychological well-being, community vitality, people's control over their time. Here, standard of living is relegated to the very bottom. It's simply one factor out of many. Then, of course, Western development thinkers have countered that in turn with the capabilities approach pioneered by Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum. That's, again, very, very broad. It takes account of physiological features, of cognitive abilities, and of social capabilities, freedom of association, freedom from discrimination, even interaction with other species, and again, environmental issues. Now, if you find this very complicated, let me draw your attention to this index, which is relies on self-reported levels of well-being. You simply go out and you ask people how happy they feel with their lives. And again, There are no big surprises, Canadian countries on top, Zimbabwe at the very bottom. But just to draw your attention to one example, modern Greece ranks in the second half of this index, and the data come from well before the current financial crisis. In fact, in this case, Greece ranks below countries like Mali and Kyrgyzstan. And I'm sure Mali and Kyrgyzstan are wonderful places to live in, but by any quasi-objective measure, Greece is doing much better than people in Mali or Kyrgyzstan. And yet, in terms of self-reported levels of well-being, you get these various discrepancies. So what is an ancient historian going to do about all this? If it's so difficult to measure well-being, quality of life, human development, even for the present, what can we hope to achieve for the more distant past, and why would it matter? That's the main issue at stake here in my presentation. Let me give you just a single example, because that's all we have time for. This is a very, very long-range view of one measure of human well-being reduced to essentials, essentially caloric intake, how much people earn on average in various societies, expressed in the most simplified fashion, the average amount of wheat, of grain, earned by an unskilled laborer in an average day, which is a pretty good index of income levels for wide sector of society. And you see that for most of the time, as far as you can track back these things, almost into the beginning of the second millennium BC in ancient Mesopotamia, for most of recorded human history, these unskilled workers who are representative of the majority of the population earned just enough to get by, about 5 liters of grain per person per day, which allows to just survive at a subsistence level. It's only in the relatively recent past, for me that's the last 600 or 700 years, that average per capita incomes really go up significantly, mostly in response to the demographic contraction brought about by the Black Death. As you can see, there are very few outliers in antiquity or prior to the late Middle Ages, more generally, where people on average enjoyed higher real incomes. I've marked them in red and orange, and those cases come from ancient Greece, Athens in the 5th and 4th centuries BC, and the Aegean island of Delos in the 3rd century BC. Which raises the question, why would ancient Greece have been privileged in this respect? Why did people enjoy higher real incomes? This is just to clarify what I just showed you. There's the usual range of income, a few liters of grain per day, which is what you find in the Roman Empire, for instance, and significantly higher rates of average incomes for unskilled workers, manual workers, in ancient Greece. Well, what's so special about ancient Greece in general, or classical Athens in particular, that would help account for this? And is this just an isolated feature, or does it go hand in hand with other elevated measures of well-being in that particular environment? Now, it's fair to say that high real wages are not an isolated phenomenon. Again, there are many different ways of measuring well-being in this particular case. Again, I'm not going to take you through all the various examples that I've listed in this slide. You can look at pretty much anything that's still discernible, visible in the record: house sizes, measures of inequality in terms of income, wealth, house sizes. Greece enjoys a very high urbanization rate. 50% of people live in nucleated settlements, which is very unusual in pre-modern systems, may well have enjoyed a higher rate of literacy. And we have very firm evidence, as many of you no doubt know, of egalitarian ideals, constraints on principles, on rulers in the Greek polis, and very high levels of military and eventually also political participation, which may very well have been instrumental in maintaining all these other various beneficial developments. Now, if you just looked at this slide, you might conclude that things were going pretty well in ancient Greece, but at the same time, and this is germane to the question of how do we capture overall quality of life, there were significant countervailing factors that would serve to offset all these beneficial developments. Gender inequality, a great deal of slavery, more so than in most other pre-modern societies, a high rate of exposure to organized violence, which was a direct function of people's inclusion in the political and military process. It's a logical corollary of being included in these processes. And then, of course, would yield all kinds of negative consequences, widows, orphans, all kinds of social measures people may have taken to account for attrition caused by high levels of violence, violence both between polities, between Greek city-states, and within the citizenry, the citizen bodies of individual states. And none of these features, obviously, would have contributed very much to quality of life. And then there are other features where we just don't know. We don't know if people in ancient Greece lived significantly longer lives, or were healthier, or taller, or physically in better shape than people elsewhere. It's possible, but we don't quite know yet. Now, what if we compare the experience of classical Greece with what went on in Greece, let's say, 1500 years later, in the Byzantine period around 1000 AD. In some cases, there are clear differences. There's little doubt that real incomes in the classical period were higher than they were in the Middle Ages. We don't know about longevity or literacy. Clearly, ancient Greeks, especially in places like Athens, had more political rights, whereas they don't in the Byzantine Empire. There's far less inequality in the Middle Ages than there was in antiquity. At the same time, gender bias seems to have become more attenuated by the medieval period. There's certainly far less slavery in the Middle Ages, and there is, at least at that time, less exposure to violent death. The ordinary average person would be less likely to be drawn into violent conflict with others between states or within the state. As a result, we don't really know how to put any kind of score or number or conclusion on quality of life, let alone gross national happiness. It's very difficult to compare overall quality of life in those two periods in the same region because of the complexity of this template where the various variables don't always match up. Now you can extend this comparison into the more recent past by looking at Greece in the decades after independence from the Ottoman Empire. And you will find if you look at the standard indicators, income, life expectancy, literacy, there aren't really substantial differences between the mid-19th century and classical Greece. Average per capita GDP expressed in real terms in amounts of grain are possibly even less than it was in classical Athens. Mean life expectancy at birth is in the 30s, as it may well have been in ancient Greece. Infant mortality is high. Literacy rates are very low, even by the beginning of the 20th century. And of course, political development was very much an ongoing process. So once again, you wonder whether you can use these indices to make any kind of meaningful comparison between quality of life in Greece in the mid-19th century and, say, in classical Athens. Well, that's certainly troubling, because if we can't, if these indices indicate that nothing much really changed between antiquity and the 19th century, well, maybe then these indices are not particularly helpful. Of course, there are long-term continuities within all pre-modern or pre-industrial societies, but at the same time, the experience of life in Greece in the late 19th century ought to have been significantly different from the experience or the quality of life in classical antiquity. And yet those indices seem incapable of capturing and delineating this kind of difference. So what are we supposed to do with this? I guess it means that the main result of this kind of long-term comparison is to highlight the complexity of the question, that there is simply no simple answer to the question, what was the quality of life like in a particular time and place? And it's very difficult to establish direct comparisons. So it seems that the most promising way forward is to move beyond those indices that I've been using here and move on to even broader conceptions of what quality of life entails, what it is all about. And that, of course, is precisely what the upcoming papers in this session will attempt to do. So my paper simply provides a historical foundation for these attempts. Thank you very much.